Have you ever wondered what Jesus really looks like? I mean, I know that Christian artists have tried to give us their impressions over the centuries, but just for a moment, let's pretend that Jesus was going to describe himself. What would that look like? Well, on today's show, we're going to find out, and I promise you, this is something that could lead to a lifetime of study. And in my case, it was life-changing. So stick around. You are not going to want to miss this. The Shroud of Turin, this old burial cloth with a man's image somehow etched into it, has been stirring controversy since it first showed up back in the 14th century. Now, judging by the marks on the body of the man etched into the cloth, this man appears to have been crucified. And some people really believe that the image is a picture of Jesus, and that it was burned into the cloth on the morning he rose from the dead. Of course, other people strongly suspect that the shroud is a forgery, that somehow a clever medieval artist painted the image on the cloth. But then again, on the other hand, in response to that, true believers point out that if the shroud is really a forgery, it's an unbelievably good one because the image is actually a negative, like the ones you used to get on film with a camera. So the big question, of course, is whether or not the shroud is real. Now, personally, I have some biblical questions about its authenticity because God seemed to make other objects that people might be tempted to venerate just disappear. For example, in Deuteronomy chapter 34, God buries Moses himself. He handles the funeral so that nobody would know where the grave was. And in 2 Kings chapter 18, when the Israelites offered incense to the bronze serpent that Moses made, well, Hezekiah had it destroyed to end the idolatry. So if God took those kinds of precautions back then, what are the odds that he would let the shroud of Jesus just slip through? Now, I could be wrong. I'll admit that. It might be the real thing. But even if it is, would it matter? The Jesus we serve is not in a tomb. He's alive, representing you as heaven's great high priest. We have something far better than a relic. But even so, why do you think there's so much fascination with this shroud? I mean, if it really is a picture of Jesus, of course, I'd be curious. I'd want to see it because, hey, I've always wanted to see Jesus. And I can't blame millions of other Christians for wanting exactly the same thing. More than anything, Christians want to see Jesus. They want to hear him. They want to be with him. But in the meantime, as we wait for Jesus, we look at him through the words inspired by the Holy Spirit in the scriptures. Of course, some people still draw pictures of what they think Jesus looked like in order to illustrate Bible stories for kids. But what are the chances those pictures, the ones that we see everywhere, actually look anything like Jesus? I mean, most of them seem to have a Jesus who comes from Northern Europe with light hair and blue eyes, when in reality he probably had an olive complexion and darker hair, just like everyone else in the Middle East. So really, we don't know what Jesus looked like. Except for this description of Jesus in the prophecies of the Bible that looks nothing like you'd expect. And in part, that's what we're going to look at today, because this is the way that Jesus himself chooses to appear, in vision. And it's a symbolic representation, which means that we can stand to learn a lot by studying it. But just before we get to that, it's time now for the Bible in the News. Last week, a resident of Wood County, Texas, filed a lawsuit because his county commissioners always start their meetings with prayer, and because they've got the motto, "In God We Trust," posted in the courthouse. Now, this is not the first time that someone has launched a First Amendment legal challenge against a government institution. But what makes this story a little unusual is the fact that the complainant has never actually set foot in that courtroom. He's never actually heard them pray, and he's never actually seen that national motto on the wall. But nevertheless, Mr. Charles Scott read about this stuff in the local paper, and that was enough to stir him to action. He feels his rights as an unbeliever are being violated. And of course, he's completely entitled to ask questions about the appropriate relationship between church and state. We are, after all, a nation that was designed with a protective wall between those two very different spheres of influence. And in his defense, I'd be the first to say that we have to be careful about keeping that wall in place, because it's that wall that actually gives us all the freedom to worship according to the dictates of our conscience. That wall protects me as much as it protects him. But at the same time, on a personal note, I can't help but wonder why, in recent years, there's been such deep resentment towards any display of religious belief posted anywhere in the public arena. Maybe you remember the battle that broke out last year over nativity scenes in the city of Santa Monica, where atheist groups jammed the system with requests for display space. Not because they really wanted to put up a holiday scene, but just because they wanted to stop Christians and take away their spots. It was a mean-spirited move, and it makes me wonder why there's so much open hostility towards Christians. I mean, you don't get that angry when someone believes in flying saucers or the Easter Bunny. So, why the resentment towards Christians? Of course, it might have something to do with the way some Christians have minimized the importance of that wall between church and state. The way that some of us are pushing a political agenda, trying to seize the reins of power so we can legislate morality. But you know, I'm not convinced that's the whole issue. Could it be that somewhere deep down, some skeptics still suspect that the gospel is true, and that's what makes them uncomfortable? Of course, in a courtroom, everybody needs to feel that they're going to get a fair hearing and that we're all in that courtroom on equal standing. It ought to be a neutral place if we can at all help it. Christians need to remember that even though we are in the majority, we cannot afford a return to the situation we had in Europe during the Middle Ages. That marriage of church and state was one of the reasons that people had to come here in the first place. So Christians, lighten up a little and learn to live with your non-Christian neighbors. It's just a fact of life. And at the same time, skeptics, may I suggest that you not protest absolutely every public display of religion? Whether you intend it or not, it's starting to look like you have a personal vendetta, especially when you're protesting something you've never actually seen or experienced yourself. Now, today we're going to look at Daniel chapter 10, a chapter that doesn't always get much attention because it doesn't have a long time prophecy like chapters 2, 7, or 8, but it does have some really astonishing material that pulls back the curtains of the universe to show us what's going on behind the scenes. This is going to be better than a hot cup of cocoa on a really cold Canadian night. I'll be right back.
How do you spark the flames of romance into a ho-hum marriage?
The truth about relationships is that the longer we are together, the lazier we become. Couples today are spending a lot of time pursuing such goals as higher income, buying nicer cars, bigger homes, and even their own individual leisure. While there's nothing necessarily wrong with these pursuits, we can't do them to the detriment of marriage. So couples need to learn that the more time they spend together, the stronger their romantic ties will be.
So they need to be intentional about doing special things with each other. Going out on dates, it was easy when you were dating, but now that you're married, you're busy and you need to be intentional about doing nice things, being nice to each other and doing those things over and over and over again.
My guest today is someone you've already met on the program a couple of times, but it's the first time that I've had a chance to sit down with Bible scholar, speaker, and podcast personality Chris Holland. He's passionate about community outreach, he's passionate about church history, he loves teaching the Bible, And most importantly, he absolutely loves Jesus. And today he's driven down from Hagerstown, Maryland to be with us on Disclosure. Chris, welcome back to the program. I'm just so glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How was the traffic on the way down from Hagerstown?
Oh, it's always pleasant in Washington, D.C.
Except that there's that new toll highway, so you actually had to pay a little something to get here tonight, right?
Yes, yeah, so it makes it very valuable.
I crossed that on my way to work in the morning, that toll highway, and they changed the prices with traffic during the day. There's a sign there, and I am just Dutch enough that I will take the little country roads for miles to avoid the 75-cent toll for the little mileage that I have to go.
Well, it's an amazing thing. I came from Chicago, and they charge us to drive on really any road in Chicago, and so it's not a new thing for me here.
So that's just no big deal. It's one toll highway. No big deal to you.
That's right.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. You've been on a few times, and as a matter of fact, I think one of the times that you were on the program, you were talking about Daniel 9, which is the chapter that comes just before the one we're looking at tonight, Daniel chapter 10. So maybe one of the best places for us to start tonight, Chris, is with a little bit of background. If we're going to sit down and read Daniel 10 for the first time, what kinds of things should we know about what's just happened in the book and what causes this scene in Daniel chapter 10?
Which, you know, it's an amazing thing, Sean. We look at Daniel 10 in the context. In Daniel chapter 8, Daniel receives the vision of the ram and the goat, and then he receives this vision of the 2300 days, which I know you have covered, and he's left sick, wondering.
All right, he doesn't understand.
He doesn't understand.
Everything's explained except that one thing about the 2300
days. One thing. And then he prays for understanding. Now, we just turn the page and we go to Daniel chapter 9 and we have the answer.
Yeah.
For Daniel, it was a 13-year wait. And in Daniel 9, he receives a vision while he's wondering specifically about how long his people are going to be captive in Babylon. What God opens up to him is not only the answer to how long they will be captive in Babylon, but the reality of how long we as a people will be captive in this earth, and gives us a peek into the great judgment.
There's a couple of layers in that Daniel 9 prophecy.
Absolutely.
And I guess this is review, and you can go back to the archives and look up that show on Daniel 9 with Chris and with Gary. I think it was Gary with you on the program that night. But there's a couple of layers there. Daniel is studying because Jeremiah wrote that Israel will be in captivity for 70 years. And he's looking at the calendar on the wall saying, you know, we must be getting close. When are we going home? When is this going to take place? And as God gives him that answer, he gives us an answer. When are we on our way home? Doesn't give a date for the second coming of Christ, but
absolutely
sets
not
the table for understanding when the time of the end would begin, when we start moving into the last phase.
That is correct. And in addition to that, the timing of this chapter is when Nehemiah is in Jerusalem. And Nehemiah's having all kinds of problems, bringing the temple back together, building the wall. And here we find Daniel once again praying, saying, almost kind of, Lord, you've promised, and what's happening here?
We've got problems with Sanballat. We've got problems. There's all kinds of opposition to rebuilding the temple. So even though it's kind of underway, it's not going well.
That's right. It's not going well at all. And so that is the context we find Daniel praying in chapter 10. And then he receives this amazing visit and vision that gives him some promise for the future.
Well, then we should probably dig right into it. That's great background. He's really wrestling with when, Lord. When. So it's really a relevant question for Christians today, because we're all waiting for something too. Our deliverance. Our deliverance from this spiritual Babylon. We want to go home. And we're waiting. So this really is promising to speak to people who are waiting for on God.
Yes. And as we read this, we will see that while it's an answer directly to Daniel, God is definitely speaking to the generation today who, as you look at the news all around, you wonder, when is anything going to get better?
Right.
When is anything going to get better? And here we're going to find some answers.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, let's dig into it. Daniel 10, verse 1. Let me read a couple of the verses and we'll just start moving into it. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. I get a kick out of the way that both names are mentioned all the way through the book of Daniel. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till the whole 3 weeks were finished. So he's clearly after something. He's looking for answers.
Yes, he's looking for answers. He's fasting in a way. He's clearly wanting to know something from God. And then in verse 4, something happens.
Well, take me in it. Verse 4, 5, and 6, because I think we really want to spend some time unpacking that. Take me into those.
Verse 4 begins, "Now on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude."
Well, that's quite a vision. I have never actually seen somebody who looks like that. So obviously we're meant to dig a little deeper than first appearances here. Never seen somebody with fire coming out of their eyes or lightning coming out of their face. This is clearly symbolic language. Who is this that Daniel sees?
We can get some hints. Now, Daniel wouldn't have had the hints that God has given us today. We go to the book of Revelation, which is the companion volume to Daniel.
Right.
And we see a being that is remarkably similar in verses 12 to 16 of Revelation chapter 1.
So it probably, to help really set the foundation, wouldn't hurt us to take a look at that.
I think it would be good for us to go to Revelation chapter 1.
Revelation chapter 1. Now, it's interesting. Daniel's in captivity. John is in captivity. There's some real parallels here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
In verses 12 through 16, we have this description. "Then I turned to see the voice that spoke with me." This is John speaking. "And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man." So we have Jesus pictured here. And how is he seen?
There's no question now who we're talking about, especially in the context of the whole chapter.
Absolutely. "Clothed with a garment down to his feet and girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and hair were like wool and as white as snow. And his eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters." And so we have all these similarities, these parallels that tell us that Daniel is having an encounter in Daniel chapter 10 with Jesus himself.
That's fascinating to me because often, you know, Christians sometimes, God bless us for doing it, hand out a lot of New Testaments. But sometimes when you just hand out the New Testament, you don't see how often Jesus actually shows up in the Old Testament. This is the same being. I mean, the description is the same. And when you line these passages up side by side, it really opens up a world of understanding. Jesus is trying to tell us something about himself.
That's right. And we're going to see as we study each of these items, Jesus is not only visiting Daniel with a message specific for Daniel, but this whole description tells us something about the very character and nature of Jesus himself. In fact, he begins by saying that the way he's dressed ought to bring to our mind something about who he is and what he's like.
Well, the big clue for me on the way he's dressed, you know, in Revelation 1 and verse 12, "And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands." Now, every week on this program, we've been highlighting that to really understand Bible prophecy, you've got to understand the Old Testament sanctuary and the imagery there. This is sanctuary language. And then he comes out dressed with a garment down to the feet, girded about the chest with a golden band. If you go back to Daniel, he's clothed in linen. What's that symbolism?
That is clearly symbolism of the dress of a priest from the sanctuary system of the Old Testament. And not only does it show up in the Old Testament, but in describing Jesus as a priest, we have some New Testament answers that tell us all about what it means that he's our priest, and it's some very reassuring promises.
But give me an example.
Well, if we go to the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 4,
okay,
and verses 14 through 16.
Now, you know, I did something stupid this week. I cut my thumb, and I've discovered how important your thumb is to thumbing through the Bible. I'm a little slow getting over to Hebrews because I can't hold the pages back with my thumb. Hebrews chapter
4, verses 14 through 16.
All right. Boy, this sticks out. I got to say, this sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yes. So I guess you'll have to finger through the Bible instead of thumb
okay.
through it. It says, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession."
Right.
"For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in our time of need.
Jesus shows up as a priest, not any priest. He's the great high priest in the heavens. I mean, there were earthly sanctuaries, and we've studied this before on Disclosure a number of times. Every one of them was a type, a foreshadow, a pattern of an actual sanctuary, the book of Hebrews says, the one that God built in heaven. So we actually have a high priest in heaven. What does this tell us about who Jesus is and what our relationship is to him? If he's dressed as a high priest, what's he trying to tell me?
Well, it's very interesting. It's almost the opposite of the fact that because we have high priests that show up in the New Testament that are very much not sympathetic to really anyone's needs.
Caiaphas.
And so Jesus now is saying, in the book of Hebrews here, he's saying that, number one, he sympathizes with us. Why does he sympathize with us? Because he was in all points tempted as we are. And while he may not have experienced the exact temptation, he in principle experienced every temptation we will face. And yet he was without sin. And then the invitation is not simply to treat him as some off distant priest, but to draw near to him. Draw near to the throne of mercy and find grace.
So this really becomes a perfect mediator. We have God who became man. He can represent God to us, but he can also represent our human race before God's throne.
That's right, because he's experienced what we've experienced. He knows who we are, and he knows how to not just reach out to us, but actually uphold us and give us strength. And Daniel needed strength here.
Yep.
And we need strength today.
That's remarkable. John sees this Jesus dressed like a priest, a mediator between us and God. I am not that distant. Daniel sees it. They're both struggling. They're both in moments of struggle. And here comes a God who gets it. He's been there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just wanted to mention one thing because you've been hounding on the point. The sanctuary is important. Hebrews 8:1. Now, this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who sitteth at the right hand of the throne of the majesty is in heavens. We are pointed to the sanctuary because it's the main point, because that's where Jesus is. It is really the headquarters for salvation in the time in which we live. So we're called to look at that place and find the promises.
Now, I want to come back to that thought in just a moment. We've run out of time for this segment. Can you believe one segment gone already? And we've only looked at the first element of the way Jesus appears, and it's a big one. We're going to come right back to it in just a moment. And in just a little bit, you're going to get your chance to jump into our discussion. Here's how you join us tonight. You can call us or you can go find us on the internet. HopeTV.org/disclosure will get you to the contacts you need, help you find us on YouTube. It'll help you find us on Facebook. Look for Disclosure Live on Facebook. Call us at 888-730-HOPE. Text me, 707-200-1099. We'll be right back with the way Jesus describes himself.
When it comes to buying medicine, some people try and buy a combination medicine, thinking that they can, with one pill, cure a multitude of problems. You know, you're going to pay a lot more if you buy combination medications than if you actually buy the pill that you need. So for instance, if you need a pain reliever, you've got a headache or you're going to take something for a headache, you don't need a multiple combination medication. An aspirin or Tylenol or something like that is going to be just fine. Then of course, if it's a headache, sometimes I have to ask ourselves, I wonder if I'm going to pay for the very prominent name brand or whether I'm going to pay for just the generic. I've got two forms of low-dose aspirin here. One costs half the price of the other. I'm not going to show you the labels, but I'm just showing you that you can get a cheaper medication. And also be very careful not to over-medicate yourself. But look at the labels, look at the contents, and compare. You'll save.
And we're back with one of the fastest-paced prophecy studies you're ever going to find anywhere. We're looking at Daniel chapter 10. I'm with Pastor Chris Holland. In a little bit, you're going to get a chance to jump into the discussion. You can call us at 888-730-HOPE. That's 4673. Or if you're living somewhere outside of North America, my apologies, I don't have a toll-free number for you, but you can still call 707-200-1099 or send a text message, which is really cheap, to 707-200-1099. It'll bounce into my iPad, and we'll see if we can handle it. And if it's really tough, I won't handle it. Pastor Holland will. Pastor Holland, just before the break, we were talking about Jesus as the high priest. Clothed in linen, he shows up. He's the mediator, the perfect mediator. He's been here. He gets it. He understands. Both Daniel and John, when they saw this vision, had been suffering. They'd been in captivity. But they'd both also seen something really important. I think Daniel had seen Jerusalem sacked and the temple destroyed, the first temple.
That's right.
The Revelation's written in the 90s A.D. The temple was sacked in 70, so it's been sacked again. And to both of these prophets in exile, both of them are prophets in exile. Both of them had seen one of the temples destroyed. Jesus appears as a high priest, which is directing our attention somewhere very important.
It is directing our eyes to heaven because the true temple, the real temple, is in heaven. The temple that God has made, the sanctuary, is in heaven. It points our eyes there. And when we go there, it is fascinating as we see the symbols open up to us, a whole realm of understanding. What sometimes are considered very difficult passages become quite easy to understand as we get in tune with the sanctuary and its symbols.
All right. Well, great. I mean, we're going to have to really move along. I mean, we've covered one aspect of the way Jesus appears. He's clothed in linen. He's dressed like a high priest, but there's more, isn't there?
That's right. His body is like beryl.
Right.
And beryl is it's a huge family of stones. But the one most common in the Middle East is the emerald, the green emerald.
So an emerald really is a beryl.
That's correct.
And it's green, which is probably important, right?
Yeah, it is. And it points us, really, because we see showing up in Revelation chapter 4 and verse 3. We can read that real quickly.
Yeah, that's a passage we spent a whole evening on, but there's a detail there that is important now that you've mentioned it.
And it opens up to us an understanding of what this being dressed in beryl, this Jesus dressed in beryl, is. And he who sat was like a jasper and sardius stone in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald.
So there's that emerald. The beryl is an emerald. It's green. Here's a green rainbow around. Now, rainbows aren't usually green.
Rainbows aren't usually green.
There's some green, but my kids could tell you. There's more than green. This rainbow is entirely green.
This rainbow is green, but it points us to that rainbow, and now all of a sudden it unlocks for us an understanding of Jesus' character and who he is, because that takes us all the way back to the first book of the Bible, Genesis 9, where God places a rainbow as a promise or a covenant, and the promise is all about how he wants to be our God and he wants us to be his people.
You know, it's interesting. The promise to Noah is, look, I'm never going to destroy the world by a flood again. Jesus shows up. The color of beryl is green. The rainbow is green. Rainbow is a symbol of God's covenant and promise that it's going to work out. Yep. And both of John and Daniel have been through traumatic experiences, and God is holding out his rainbow. He's holding green, also a color of hope. You know, it's used universally as a color of hope. God's saying, you can count on me, isn't he?
That's right. And it's very interesting. When you think about the promises of Jesus and the promise of his covenant and that promise of hope, many times as Christians, most of us have memorized John 3:16. And I really wish that most of us would memorize the verse just following that as well, because Jesus there says he has not come to the world to condemn the world.
Right.
But he's come that the world might be saved through him. So the mission of Jesus, the promise of Jesus is, I've not come to condemn. I've come to save. And you were saying this earlier, sometimes as Christians, we come across as more condemning than saving. And Jesus arrives on the scene, and this description is speaking loud and clear. I'm here to save, not to condemn.
Powerful, powerful. Both John and Daniel are struggling. When is the promise going to come to pass? Here comes the green, the color of hope. And it brings up that rainbow around God's throne, the green rainbow, the emerald rainbow. I am a God of promise, and my promises will stick.
That's correct.
Powerful. Well, there's more. Boy, we always struggle to get through the material on disclosure, but in particular tonight, Boy, there's so much here. We could probably spend an hour on each one of these aspects, but let's keep going. Body is like beryl, it's green, but there's more.
Then it says his face is like lightning. And, you know, and again, you know, as children, we grow up being very fearful of lightning. But when you start looking throughout the Bible, you start finding out that lightning is symbolic and happens at the very presence of Jesus. Exodus 19, Revelation 4, we could go on and on. But that lightning is that God is present. He's right there with us. He's not somewhere off an absentee landlord, but he's there. He's present for us.
It's amazing. You know, when I think about this, his face is lightning. It's brilliant. There is a story in the Old Testament of a brilliant face. And it's Moses in Exodus 33 and 34. He says to God, show me your glory, which is something that most sinners, I think, would regret if God were to really just show everything at that moment. But God says, look, I'm going to show you my name. Now, it doesn't mean he's going to write it down on a slip of paper and say, here you go, Moses, here's my name. What he does next is describe his character. I'm merciful. I'm compassionate. I'm just. God's name is his character. And when Moses comes down after witnessing the character of God, his face is so brilliant in some of these places in the story that Israel's afraid. He's got a face like lightning, it seems. And Jesus says, hey, look, I've come to show them your name, Father. He prays to the Father in John 17.
That's right. That's right. He's come to show his name. Why? Because his name is all about this compassion, mercy, graciousness, kindness. And it's almost as if God, and we'll talk about this in a moment, while we are to revere God and he is holy, he's reaching out to us and he wants us to understand he's got compassion. He's kind. He's gentle. He wants to be with us. He wants to be there. He wants to be present with us.
Amazing. It's amazing. You know, it's also interesting to me that eventually the Bible says that God's name is written in our foreheads. It's Revelation 14, verse 1. We stand on Mount Zion with the Lamb and God's name. If his name is his character, and that's what he revealed to Moses as his glory, and Moses shone, and Jesus shines with the glory of God, isn't there an inference then in the last days God's expecting us to show the character of God to the world as well?
You know, it's actually quite interesting, that passage, Revelation 14, 1, where it says his people will be marked on the forehead. That word, that Greek word there, can actually be translated in or on. And in the forehead is your frontal lobe, which is all about decision-making and character-making.
Moral judgments.
And it's very interesting. Jesus in John chapter 13, in I believe it's verse 35, he could choose a multitude of things on how people of the world will know his people. And he says, this is how the world will know that you're my disciples.
Amazing.
That you have love for one another.
You have love for one another.
And so this character of God is in the forehead. It becomes a very part of who we are as God's people and as Christians.
Of course, it was everything that Jesus was. The Bible says that in him dwells the fullness of the Godhead bodily. Jesus shows us who God is. His face is like lightning. Oh my goodness, we could spend an hour on that one, but we have to keep moving. Show me a little bit more. We've got a few minutes before the next break.
It goes on to say his eyes are like torches of fire. Again, this scene to us may seem like, wow, that would be really frightening. And we'll see in just a moment that there were some that were quite frightened and trembled. But again, fire, God's presence, God's protection. Because we have his presence. Exodus 3, verse 2, Moses sees God, Jesus, in a burning bush. And what is it? It's fire. That fire is his presence.
Presence of God.
And then in Exodus chapter 40, how does God protect his people? By a pillar of fire.
Right. It's presence of God.
It is the presence of God. It is the protection of God. And so but then it's talking not just about his presence and protection, but it's talking about his eyes. And his eyes, I think, we were talking, his eyes tell us a little something that's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, the Bible says this in 2 Chronicles 16, 9, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro through the earth. Eyes are a symbol of what you see. They're also a symbol of knowledge. The little horn power we saw a while ago has eyes in the little horn, and it has its own knowledge too. But eyes are knowledge. But God's eyes have fire in it. His presence is in his knowledge. But it also means that he kind of illuminates what he sees. He doesn't just see it. He casts light on what he sees.
That's right. And it's so interesting that he casts light on what he sees, yet he still loves us. Romans chapter 5 says that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. He illuminates and exposes everything about us. Yet he chooses still to love us.
That's remarkable, because I know, you know, it's not easy to open the Bible and get a picture of who you really are, because we sit there and think, oh my goodness, not much hope for me. God knows all that and more. He sees things that you haven't even noticed yet, and yet he loves you.
And it's amazing. The Bible is full of characters, full of real people that have all kind of character flaws. The Bible doesn't attempt to hide it, but God's very presence, his eyes, expose it. And we'll see in just a moment, it gives us hope, though. He doesn't leave us exposed and naked for the world to see, but he gives us hope.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, this stuff is powerful. He has eyes like torches of fire. We're going to get to his arms and feet and his voice in just a moment. But in his time, can you believe it? We're through two segments. We're going to have to take another little short break. Now, don't forget to start sending us your questions. You can call us, 888-730-HOPE. You can text me at 707-200-1099. We're in Daniel chapter 10, looking at the way Jesus presents himself. It's a powerful picture. We're going to be back in just a moment to continue our study. I'm with Pastor Chris Holland. I'll be right back.
Jesus said, "You'll receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. You'll be witnesses for me." And that work of being a witness for Christ, that way of life, continues until the very end of the age, so that all can hear the good news about Jesus. We'll talk about evangelism and witnessing as a perpetual ministry this week on Hope Sabbath School.
And we're back, and we have got Nick on the line. We're studying Daniel chapter 10, and we're talking about the way Jesus presents himself after his resurrection and ascension in Revelation chapter 1, and the way he chose to present himself before his incarnation to Daniel in Daniel chapter 10, and the lessons that we can learn from that. But we've got Nick on the phone with a question for Pastor Holland tonight. Nick, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. Nick, has it been raining down? You're calling from Florida?
Yes.
Yeah, it's been raining a little bit down there, hasn't it?
Actually, it's been raining a lot.
Yeah, I've heard that. Hey, what's your question for Pastor Holland tonight?
When Jesus once walked the earth, will he look the same as when God comes?
Okay, so Nick, let me be clear. Are you asking, when Jesus comes again, is he going to look the same as he did when he was here on earth?
Yes.
Oh, well, there's an interesting question. And it has to do with what we're talking about a little bit. Pastor Holland, what do you think? When Jesus comes again, is he going to look like he did when he went back to heaven 2,000 years ago?
It's very interesting. We can assume that there are going to be some things the same, because after Jesus was resurrected, after Jesus had ascended, he appears to the disciples. He has marks in his hands.
Right.
He has a wound in his side. We have an Old Testament prophecy in the Minor Prophets.
I believe Zechariah,
where a child asks him, "What are the marks in your hand?" And so Jesus is bearing the marks of his human existence. And so we think we have pretty good indication that Jesus will look very similar to how he looked.
You know what I would do, Nick? I tend to agree with that answer a lot, but I think the real clincher would be when Jesus comes back, grab one of the disciples and ask him, does he look the same now? Because they're the only ones who would actually know beyond the shadow of a doubt.
That's right. We don't have any pictures. We don't have any videos. And so we'll, and some of us, as you did in your opening, we're going to be vastly surprised when he doesn't come with wavy blonde hair and blue eyes, probably. So.
All right. Well, we've looked at the torches of fire in his eyes. We've got a couple more elements that we need to look at. His arms and feet, this is in Daniel 10, verse 6. His arms and feet like burnished bronze in color. Actually, over in the book of Revelation chapter 1, it talks about brass that's been refined in the fire. What's this telling us? His hands and feet are like polished bronze or brass, or like brass that's been in the fire, depending on which version you're looking at. What do we learn?
Well, it's very interesting. The reference to hands and feet is it would be too coincidental that the mention of hands and feet happened, because that is where Jesus is pierced, in his hands and his feet. He's crucified by his hands and
Amazing.
His feet. So I don't think that's accidental. Then, interestingly enough, we have a metal that's an alloy. Brass or bronze are two metals that come together. It could be alluding to the fact of Jesus's Jesus' nature, fully God, fully human. Two natures blended together. Don't know how exactly it works, but somehow, some way it came together.
Well, that would make sense in the fact that he starts out presenting himself as the mediator and the high priest. We have such a high priest who cannot, you know, who is touched by the feeling of our infirmities, who understands. That's because he has those two natures, fully human, fully God. He stands in that gap between us and God. He's the perfect representative for the human race. He's the perfect representative for God. And, you know, while I don't think there's probably enough to build a giant case on it, I tend to agree that the fact that it's an alloy says something. And maybe it's referring to that dual nature, and it would be powerful if it were. I think that's beautiful. But it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, why the hands and feet? Why is it directing our attention there? What do we learn about those symbolically in prophecy?
Well, it's very interesting. The feet are symbolic of ownership or possession. We've got Job chapter 1 where God and Satan are having this interaction, and God asks him, from where have you come? Now, God knew where he had come from, and Satan's answer is, from to and fro, walking upon the face of the earth. Why does he say that?
Well, he's not really just trying to say, look, God, here's where I've been. It's not really a, where have you been tonight, young man? He's making a statement, isn't he?
That's right. Yeah, he's not giving a pictorial vacation tour to God. But God knows, but he's making a statement. I've come from the place where my feet have tread, which, by the way, means it's under my power and my ownership. Because we have Old Testament references. God tells Abraham, wherever you walk, this is the land
that
I will give
you. Take a walk, you will own it. It's interesting. Well, ancient soldiers, you know, they depict it in the movies, but never stopped to think about why do they put their foot on the throat of their enemy when they're about to slay them? I own you.
That's right.
I own you.
It's that sense of ownership. And it's very interesting, and again, not coincidental, that when Jesus comes again, the Bible says his feet never touch the earth.
In 1 Thessalonians 4, we're caught up into the air to meet Jesus.
That's right. Why is that? Well, because Jesus has not yet taken full ownership of the earth because, as you've studied previously, you have 1,000 years, a millennium, where Satan and his angels are held captive on this very planet.
Right. And meanwhile, the books of judgment are open in heaven, Revelation chapter 20.
That's correct.
It's like we get a chance to review everything before, in Zechariah 14, Jesus' feet actually touch the planet.
That's right.
And then he takes full ownership. But He earned the ownership. It's his kingdom that he sets up at that point. But it says in Revelation 1 he was burned earning that kingdom.
That is correct. And it's that refiner's fire. And the interesting thing here is this characteristic, Sean, again, seems to be reaching out, because we can talk about Jesus' ownership of the earth and Jesus' ownership of the church, and we keep it at that arm's length. But Jesus seems to be speaking more personally here that he wants to have ownership. And he wants to have ownership of us, our heart, so he might draw near to us, even as we have been exposed fully by his eyes. But his eyes, that fire, also represent the refiner's fire. And then, as we saw in Acts chapter 2, the tongues of fire, the
right.
Holy Spirit.
Right.
It's, again, this presence. It's an amazing thing that we're seeing here, that Jesus is laying out this characteristic as a promise to Daniel.
We've got a couple of minutes left to hit the last point here. Man, we could have an hour on every one of these. The sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. In Revelation 1, it said like the voice of many waters. And of course, it's virtually saying the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Because as we know in Revelation, waters represent multitudes, peoples, tongues, languages. And so Jesus has the voice of a multitude. He's not exclusive. He's inclusive. He is representative of all of us.
He speaks for all of us. He truly represents the whole human race. And I love the fact that he has the voice for the human race. Because honestly, if I were escorted right into the throne room of God right now at this moment, what would I say?
And it's very interesting. One of my favorite verses in the Bible, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 1. He says, my little children, I write these things to you that you might not sin. But if you do sin, you have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. And so, like you said, you come into the presence of God and you feel exposed, but Jesus actually invites you to come because he represents as mediator and advocate.
He'll do the speaking.
That's right.
He'll do the speaking, which is great news. You know, even in prayer sometimes, I don't know what to say, but it says that the Spirit intercedes for us with groanings that can't be uttered.
That's correct.
Jesus speaks for us. I can't believe we've gone through another segment. We're going to be right back with some more questions on Daniel chapter 10. We'll take your calls live. If you'd like to call in and talk about this appearance of Jesus, we're going to take a look at some of the behind-the-scenes things that happen in Daniel chapter 10 that are absolutely mind-blowing, and it's a lot to accomplish in one segment, so you're going to want to buckle your seatbelts and not go anywhere. We're going to be right back. I'm with Pastor Chris Holland. Our subject is Jesus as he appears in Daniel chapter 10. I will be right back.
In 2006, a whopping $5 billion was spent on energy drinks in the USA. These drinks are laced with varying amounts of caffeine. So, what are the effects on the kids? Well, in the emergency room, physicians and pediatricians are seeing more and more cases of caffeine toxicity. Caffeine causes an increase in urine production and can result in dehydration. The individual then feels dizzy and lightheaded because of low blood pressure. Caffeine can also cause the heart to race, and severe overdoses can even cause heart attacks. The kids are affected too by all the extra calories, contributing to the growing obesity problem. Take note of what your kids are drinking. Emphasize pure water and pure fruit juice. Watch the calories, however. This will bring health and help them to break the enslaving habit.
And we're back looking at Daniel chapter 10, and I believe we've got Elaine on the line tonight. How are you doing tonight?
I am fine.
Great.
Listen, I just love you gentlemen. Love you gentlemen.
Well, that
God bless you both.
That is so nice of you. Where are you calling from tonight?
I'm calling from Buffalo.
Buffalo.
New York.
I understand that once in a while you get a little snow in Buffalo.
I hope so.
Hey, what's your question tonight?
Not to take you off tangent too much, but chapter 1 of Ezekiel.
Right.
Ezekiel is in vision.
Right.
And I just need to know, because you're saying that the two, Daniel and Revelation, we are to apply, it's symbolic, and there are some meanings we are to apply to them. I just want to know if chapter 1, 26 to 28, should we apply the same thing as in Daniel and Revelation?
Oh,
for these signs, because you know it's describing the Son of Man sitting on the throne and sapphire, made of sapphire and all of that stuff. I just want to ask you to explain this one also.
Okay,
or do we apply the same thing?
Well, we probably, Elaine, probably can't hit it in huge detail in the minutes that we have left in the program. But I'll touch on that for a moment, and Pastor Holland, you too. But because I think there are definitely similar elements that show up. There is a rainbow there, and he does see a throne lifted up high above these cherubim. So there's cherubim. We had a study on Revelation 4 and 5 some weeks ago where we looked at the living creatures and the cherubim and saw there was a link here. I think there are definitely common elements.
And I think Ezekiel gives some background information to understanding Daniel. What I would caution is we probably need to be very careful with the book of Ezekiel and making application to way in the future. And the book of Ezekiel is a major study on its own, and the chapter 1 is a major study. But you have lightnings, you have this, the cherubim, as you've mentioned, this rainbow. There are similarities. They're pointing us in the right direction. What I would caution to anyone studying the book of Ezekiel is making application far in the distant future, right, because I think Ezekiel had another purpose.
Well, there are some real common elements here, Elaine. I think we'd say, look, there's the rainbow, there's the throne, the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God in Ezekiel 1:28. There's sapphire stone, which is not like emerald. It's blue. And that's a color that, well, we're going off on a tangent, it would take a whole show, but typically represents God's moral law.
And we have the appearance of fire.
And fire.
So, I mean, there are definitely some common elements. It should catch our eye, give us some background information.
Anytime you go into the presence of God in vision or into the throne room, you're going to find the similar elements. I think it's a fruitful study.
Yes.
Okay, well, we have minutes left. In Daniel chapter 10, there is at least one, well, there's a dozen things I want to touch on with you and ask you about. But let's talk about what happens after the vision. Because it gets into a little bit of detail about what it is, the message for Daniel. He's been struggling chapters 8 and 9 to understand, and he's wondering why the delay, and then a mind-boggling thing happens here. We find out what some of the delay is about letting Israel go back to the promised land.
That's correct. We find about there's this fight, this war behind the scenes between the Prince of Persia and Gabriel and Michael. Gabriel and Michael are fighting not against one another, but together against the Prince of Persia. And it begins to give some promise and hope to Daniel on why this delay is. And I know, but probably we need to talk about who the Prince of Persia is.
Right. In minutes, we can't. I guess here's the background scenario that we probably need to get clear is Cyrus is the one who conquers Babylon.
We've
studied
right.
that. He sacks Babylon, goes under the wall. Now comes the moment, do we send the Jews back home? Are they going to rebuild their city? And Cyrus is the one who really inaugurates that. He gets that underway. But in this vision, Daniel is told, look, there's somebody who doesn't want this to happen. And they're trying to persuade Cyrus not to let Israel go back to the promised land. So we get a behind the scenes look. There are heavenly powers working on Cyrus, but there are also fallen angels who are working on Cyrus at the same time, which is powerful. It shows us that political decisions aren't just political decisions. There's behind the scenes stuff that's going on. As the world keeps moving towards the second coming of Christ, there's somebody who's trying to stop God's will from being done.
That's right. And that's what's happening here. Isaiah prophesies that Cyrus is going to be the one, the anointed one, that will bring God's people back. If Satan can stop it, it means that the Bible is not true. And so there's this wrestling. And what it tells us is that what we see around us is not all that's going on around us. And in fact, in the book of Ephesians, it tells us that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities and powers. Behind the scenes, there is this great controversy, this great cosmic battle between good and evil, between Christ and Satan, ultimately battling over the souls, battling over the people of this earth. And for Cyrus, there's a battle going on. And the reality is, there's a battle going on over each and every one of us.
You know, it's interesting because each of the empires that come up, we're back to Daniel 7 thinking now about the beast coming out of the water, the wind is blowing on the water, the winds of warfare and strife, one kingdom after another comes up. But at the end of the story, in every one of these prophecies, God establishes his permanent kingdom.
That's correct.
So stuff happens on earth, and God's message through all these prophecies is his will is going to be done. But he's doing it in such a way that he's trying to bring us all along for the ride and not lose anyone. You know, God is not willing that any should perish, Peter writes, not even one.
That's right.
So he takes just enough time to make sure we don't get left out.
And he's promising to Daniel here. He's making a promise to Daniel while there may be delay. Don't worry, Daniel. I'm in control. Where there is wrestling going on behind the scenes that you're not aware of, so be okay with it. And he's speaking to us personally because we can keep it at an arm's length. But he's speaking to Chris, he's speaking to Sean, and he's saying, listen, I know that you're desperate. I know that you don't have all the answers, but there's some wrestling going on behind the scenes. Hang on, look to the sanctuary, find answers, find hope, find promise, because the Bible gives us the end of the story. Jesus wins. Jesus wins.
Right. He does prevail. Cyrus does send them home. And the message is he becomes a type. Cyrus lets God's people go back to the old earthly Jerusalem. And he's called God's anointed in the prophecies.
That's right.
There is a king, another king coming from the east who's going to liberate us, take us out of spiritual Babylon into the new Jerusalem. And God's saying, be patient. I know it seems like it's a long time, but I'm bringing the whole world along for the ride. And you're going to make it.
That's right. And each of us can rest assured in that hope that he brings to us.
But can you believe it? We have burned through an entire program very nearly. Thank you so much, Pastor Holland, for taking us into Daniel 10. I wish we had about three more hours on it. Now, don't you go away, because I got a few more thoughts on Daniel chapter 10. And next week, we're going to pick up on some more stuff in the book of Daniel. I'm going to be right back with a few more thoughts on Daniel 10. Don't you go anywhere. We will be right back. Thank you.
Better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord bestows favor and honor. No good thing does he withhold from those whose walk is blameless. Lord Almighty, blessed is the one who trusts in you.
Daniel 10 begins with this stunning portrait of Jesus, the one who eventually replaces all worldly kingdoms with an indestructible kingdom of his own. But Daniel 10 also shows us something about what actually takes place behind the scenes before that kingdom is established. What happens in the political arena, we discover, is not merely a matter of human decision. There are other forces at play, forces that try to persuade us to move in one direction or another. That was obviously happening when Cyrus was making decisions about liberating the Jews. Someone did not want that to happen, and you can understand why. If Israel returned to the land of promise, it meant Messiah would come. It meant that it was really going to happen. The seed of the woman was going to crush the head of the serpent. And on top of that, if Cyrus actually liberated God's people, he was going to give us a prophecy of the second coming, prefiguring another king from the east who comes to deliver us from spiritual Babylon and take us home to the new Jerusalem. It's a powerful story, and it says something very important to you. It's not just heads of state and people of influence are caught up in this struggle between light and dark. There's also someone trying to keep you from making right decisions. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, as Pastor Holland mentioned tonight, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." If only we could see it. If only we could see the struggle behind the scenes. If only we could comprehend what a decision for or against God really tells the whole universe. It sends a signal when you cast your lot with God, or if you cast it against Him. Fallen angels have been spreading the message that nobody would ever choose God of their own free will, not if they had a choice. And unfortunately, millions have been listening to them. Millions have these horribly twisted ideas of what God is like, and they help spread the lie that God is arbitrary or that God is not trustworthy. But you know, when you choose Christ, it exposes their rebellion for what it is. It rips the mask off the devil's lies. When you choose Christ, you're making a statement about the character of God that reverberates throughout the entire universe. You're telling everybody that God is everything He's ever claimed to be. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4:9 that we are a spectacle to the angels and to the world. People are watching, and they're learning something about God through the choices that you make. So right now, at this moment, you'll discover there's a behind-the-scenes battle that's being fought in your house, right now, in your home. There are forces trying to get you to decide one way or the other, forces trying to make you make the right decision or the wrong decision. God will not violate your will, but He's there asking you to choose Jesus Christ. You can be a part of His eternal kingdom. Forces working in your home, and right now, at this moment, you've got the deciding vote. I'm Sean Boonstra, and you've been watching Disclosure.